Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Stavroporos, and welcome to our special election series of Reasonable and Necessary. You'll hear what Australia's NDIS portfolio leaders have planned for our NDIS. And what a lineup! Linda Reynolds, Bill Shorten, and Jordan Steele John. And in our final episode, we will bring together Australia's leading disability advocates to analyse everything that's been said. The questions I'm asking have come from you, sourced from advocacy organisations who have partnered with me to bring you this very important series. First up, the current Minister for the NDIS, Senator Linda Reynolds. Check it out. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Hi, George. It's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
It's really good to have you. I'm very excited to talk to you about your plans for the NDIS. If you're in charge of the NDIS after the next election, what will be your priorities?
Well, George, thanks. It's a great question. It's something that I've been thinking a lot about, obviously. First of all, we have to be re-elected and I have to be reappointed as the minister. But if that does happen, not only would I be very proud to continue on as the minister for the NDIS, but it's clear to me now that we need to continue at a sustainable pace reform of the scheme, because obviously the last few years were all about bringing in 250,000 people from state, very different state and territory schemes, and also to bring in nearly 250,000 people for the first time receiving disability supports, while at the same time setting up the NDIS, you know, the procedures and a really complex social policy, which was somewhat constrained by the legislation. But now that we've got, you know, over 500,000 Australians into the scheme, the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years is really, I think, about maturing the scheme. We've had a lot of reviews and, you know, most notably the Tune review, which made it very clear that we need to do more reforms with a focus on participants. So I was very glad that on the last sitting day of the last parliament, in fact, in the last few hours, we got, with the support of Labor and many of the crossbenchers, we got the first significant legislative reform of the NDIS through. And I'm really proud of that, because that implements into law the participant service guarantee. And I've heard from so many people over the last 12 months that they want the scheme to be simpler, you know, more easy to understand, but also to be a much better participant experience sort of across the board. So to answer the question, we have to now look at participants and what their needs are. So I started, so it's not only the participant service guarantee, but it's also making the scheme more accessible from people from cold communities, from First Nations communities, but also for people with intellectual and cognitive disabilities, to make sure that the scheme really works for everybody. So there's a number of big areas. We need to do more work on early childhood interventions, and, you know, work out how we do that more effectively. We've got reforms we still need to do on SDA, on SIL. So there's a lot of work to be done now to make sure that the scheme is a better experience, but also that we mature the processes.
Will you make any changes to eligibility or to how funding allocations are made?
Well, George, there's a couple of parts to that. Firstly, is that, you know, our commitment has absolutely been on, you know, from the Morrison government to fully fund the scheme. And as you know, that's what we've done. So we've locked into the budget for the next 4 years, $157 billion, to make sure that the scheme is fully funded. I think that in the legislation, they got it right. Labor Party, along with our support, got it right that decision-making should be done separately from politicians. And that's why there is an independent process by the NDIA. There's also review processes in place, separate from politicians. So I think it should still continue to be independent of politicians on the day and decide on what is reasonable and necessary.
Thank you, Linda. How concerned are you about the sustainability of the scheme?
Well, George, I think that sustainability, I think that everybody should be concerned about the sustainability. And sustainability doesn't mean cuts. Sustainability really means that it is affordable into the long term. So we have made sure that for the next 4 years in the budget, that it is fully funded. But again, you know, it's important to remember that as the federal minister responsible, I'm also accountable to Australian taxpayers. And we need to make sure that the money is being spent for the purposes that the Australian taxpayers are investing in this scheme. So it's not about cuts. It's actually now about making sure that the scheme survives and sustains into, you know, for many generations to come.
So where would you be looking for cuts, if you were to look for cuts?
I absolutely am not looking for cuts. Ed, can I just say, this is one of the really mischievous messages that's gone out by some, is there are no cuts. There have been no cuts to the scheme. In fact, we've put over $40 billion extra into the scheme over the next 4 years to make sure that the scheme is fully funded. So I'm absolutely not looking at cuts. And again, as a politician, I don't have any say in decision making for people's plans, and I shouldn't, and nor should any politician.
Let's look at workforce now. Workforce is a real concern.
Yes.
Particularly for participants who rely on a workforce to turn up to deliver services. What will you do to address the increase in the shortages in the workforce that we're seeing?
Look, George, that's another really good question, and it's something that I've spent a lot of my time focusing on. Because when you think about this, we've done a pretty extraordinary thing with the NDIS together as a parliament and as a nation. We've taken what was an $8 billion industry before the NDIS, and that was the total investment in disability supports and services right across the nation by all states and territories and the Commonwealth government. And again, sort of around about 250,000 Australians were receiving those sort of supports. Now, you know, you roll forward 8 years and we now have 500,000 people who are funded for disability supports. And as you and I both know, it's not health support, it's not aged care support, it's not mental health support, because we have sectors to provide that support more generally. This is for disability support. So we've taken that $8 billion market and in the space of, you know, less than 8 years have turned it into a $30+ billion a year market. And with 250,000 more people receiving disability supports, the workforce has had to grow really rapidly. So the workforce has grown rapidly, and we've got, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of more providers, large and small, but that's still not enough. So what we've done in the last budget, we've invested nearly $250 million into a care and support workforce, because it's not just in the disability sector. We're providing more and more supports in the aged care sector, and that's, you know, obviously we're an aging population as well, and for veterans. So we do really need to increase and find more people and to recruit them into the sector. As you well know, we don't just want anybody. We want people who want to be there and who are really suited to the caring profession. So we've got a very comprehensive workforce plan that we delivered, as you would have seen, for a five-year workforce NDI specific workforce plan. So we're doing a lot of things, but ultimately we need to recruit more people as support workers, but also for allied health services as well, because we're now providing more people with those supports than ever before.
have a friend who recently said to me that her support worker, who was one of her best support workers, had to leave the country because of visa issues and the fact that we don't currently have a visa program that supports the disability workforce. Do you think that there is a need to look at our visa offers and look at that as an option?
I think we need to do two things, George. One is we need to create and will train and interest more people into the profession here in Australia, which is why we launched the A Life Changing Life campaign, which has had success in quite a lot of success in actually bringing people into the sector to have a look at the sector, how they can get trained, and you know, what are the opportunities. So we need to make it more attractive for people in Australia to want to go into the care and support sector. But I think you're right, and it's something that I had been discussing, and I have been discussing with the Minister of Immigration and also the Minister for Foreign Affairs, is now that our borders are open again to the rest of the world, how do we attract more people in? So it's getting the balance right between them both.
That's right. I'd like to turn now to an issue that's very close to my heart. I recently did an interview with a woman who's been stuck in hospital for almost a year waiting for an NDIS plan. You know that there's a call for faster decisions around housing and support. How long do you think that these decisions should be taking?
Look, I absolutely agree that we need to reform processes to make sure that quick decisions are made faster, but also I want to make sure that we're still making the right decisions. So we've got the PSG now in legislation.
So
but
that?
I think
the
participant service guarantee. I had started a lot of work with the NDIS about red tape reduction and reform. So one of the things to help with that is in the legislation that was just passed, so that people can have much quicker variations to their plans without having to go through a full plan review. So if something happens when someone's got a plan, you know, something unexpected happened, they can now go to the NDIA and ask for a quick plan variation to meet their needs. So I think that, you know, that is one practical measure that we've implemented. And so the NDIA, to their credit, have been reporting, even without it being legislated, the participant service guarantee metrics, and they've been doing that for pretty much as long as I've been the minister. And if you have a look at their quarterly reports, the majority of those timeframes are being met. But I think there is no question that part of the reforms that we've got, the journey we've got to continue on with, is how can we keep reducing those decision times down, but also making sure that people are getting the right plan and that the right decisions are being made. So it's a bit of a balance, but there is still definitely more work to be done on that.
I'd like to turn to a really serious issue, and that's the issue of violence, abuse, neglect and exploitation of human disabilities. What do you believe that governments need to be doing more of in this area? And I say governments because it's both state, federal, it's at the local level as well.
Look, all governments do have responsibility for this, but for the federal government, we introduced, you know, the coalition government, we introduced the commission because that hadn't been established by the, you know, the previous Labor government. So I think, look, the commission itself has a significant responsibility in this area. I think they've done a fantastic job because don't forget they stood up from scratch. Just 4 years ago, and created a new national regulatory framework, because this was a sector, and people quickly forget that before the Commission and before the NDIS, this was pretty much an unregulated sector. So providers were not used to being regulated or being held to account for how they looked after and cared for participants. So the commission, I think, is an important part of that process, but there are certainly areas of improvement. I was really proud to have been able to take through the Anne-Marie Smith bill, which did deal with a lot of the issues and the holes in the system that became very apparent from that unbelievably awful case and the way that Anne-Marie Smith was neglected and eventually died. So the commission is an important part of that, but the commission's responsible not just for ensuring quality and safeguarding, but they're also important stewards of the market itself, because we've got to find a balance between ensuring that standards continue to improve in terms of, you know, safeguarding our participants and also providing really quality care options. But we've also got to make sure that the market is viable, that people can, you know, still want to and still earn a living effectively in the sector. So there's more work to be done for the commission, and the new commission has certainly hit the commissioner has hit the ground running, having a look at sort of the issues of registration and how we can strengthen quality and safeguards, but how we can also make it more effective for the sector as well. And, you know, again, states and territories also have a responsibility, because don't forget the National Disability Agency itself is administering an insurance scheme. So states and territories also have a responsibility in terms of their own areas of responsibility. So not the criminal justice system, but also for guardianships and, you know, other sort of areas of responsibility. So look, it's a shared responsibility, George.
I was really shocked when I saw that the provider for Anne-Marie Smith, who was actually a registered provider, her provider was only fined $13,000. Surely that's not good enough.
Well, George, I certainly don't want to comment on sort of any particular decision, but I think that there are certainly improvements that must keep being done. I think a lot of improvements will come. As you know, we set up the Royal Commission into the abuse, neglect and exploitation of people with disability. And, you know, we're hearing some pretty shocking things being exposed through the Royal Commission that we established. So we've invested in that Royal Commission $500 million. And we haven't been waiting for the final report. So we have been constantly looking at the evidence that's going into the Royal Commission, and also, you know, what are some of the things that we can do to improve. But certainly after their final report, I think there is no doubt that, you know, the Australian Parliament and states and territory governments as well will have to look at what more we need to do to improve the quality of service, but also the safeguarding.
Yeah, I also think that when we look at, you know, the issue of neglect, it's very, you know, it's everywhere. I mean, I even think that, you know, being stuck in hospital for a year to me feels like, you know, and neglect issue.
So just on, George, just on the hospital issue, you raised that before. It is something that I have been at sort of all six meetings that I've had with state and territory ministers over the last just over 12 months, at the issue of YPRAC and, you know, how we actually support
what that means.
Young people in residential aged care. So we've got people both in aged care, and we need to actually, for those who want to have, you know, another housing option and support option, how do we get and stop younger people going into inappropriately into aged care? But we've also got people in hospitals, as you said, who either are waiting for an NDIS housing decision, so SDA, or they're waiting for public housing. It's something that I've been discussing extensively with state and territory ministers and also raising with the state and territory housing ministers because, again, in our wonderful federation, it's a shared responsibility. So we've got some responsibility through specialist disability accommodation for about 5% of NDIS participants. And the states and territories have a responsibility to provide affordable and accessible public housing. So neither one of us can solve it alone, and we have to keep working together to find a solution for that. So with hospitals, again, it's a shared responsibility because the NDIA doesn't necessarily know that a participant is in a hospital if they're already a participant. And each state and territory has very different record keeping processes. So we're working with, and I've been working with states and territories to get a consistent approach to reporting. So the NDIA now has hospital liaison staff in every state and territory to work with the state system so that we can identify NDIA participants because we have to be notified by someone that people are in hospital. And then so that we can start looking for arrangements for them for post-hospitalisation support. And also, if we've got somebody in hospital who doesn't yet have a plan, you know, the state system has to tell us that they're there early enough so we can actually start working with them to assess them for a plan, but also for many people to actually find them a state, public housing option if that's what they need. So again, it's a shared responsibility. And, you know, we are making progress in our discussions, but we haven't quite cracked it yet.
Yeah, we're definitely doing it. So I said at the start, but it's all parts of government need to be really focused on this. Absolutely. I'd like to turn to the issue of appeals now, Linda, NDIS appeals. We have, I recently saw some statistics around the NDIS appeals, and I was very, very shocked by how those numbers are going up and up. We know that these appeal processes are very, very traumatic and also quite expensive. What will you do to address the growing number of people going to the courts so that they can get the support that they need?
Yeah, actually, George, this is an interesting question, and it's obviously very topical at the moment. But I think the context of this is really important. Overall, the number, remembering we've got 500,000 people now on the scheme, so the overall percentage of people who are going through to the AAT appeals process is still minuscule. And most of those people who do go to the AAT, over 90% of those are settled before, as part of the early AAT process. And so it's important that people have an avenue to appeal to the AAT. So I think the context on this is really important, George. Most are settled. And again, it's a tiny fraction still, but the numbers have gone up to over 500,000 now, proportionally, you'd expect the numbers going to the AAT would correspondingly sort of increase. And the caseload has changed over time because there's not so many access cases now because, we've got 500,000 people on the scheme, but it is evolving into making appeals about their package or some elements of their package itself. But again, there is funding available through DSS to assist people who are in financial hardship to go through that process. And in fact, in the last budget, we've just put $100 million more into that appeals process to make sure that people on the scheme do actually have access to funds for the very small percentage of people who actually do go through to an appeal.
Okay, let's turn to that then. On the issue of assistance and advocacy, what I'm hearing on the ground is that advocacy services are quite overwhelmed by work around NDIS appeals. Do you think that we need to really look at that and actually look at meeting that unmet need?
Well, that's some of this actually sits within Anne Rustin's policy portfolio. So we've been working on this issue together, which is why that we've increased by 88 million baseline funding for both the NDAP and the NDIS appeals program over the last 3 years. So we do know that we do people do require support. And again, as I've said, we've also had the $100 million for the next 4 years in baseline funding for NDIS appeals in particular. So it is important that all participants have access and support where they need it to merit reviews in the system. And that's exactly what, obviously, what the AAT is.
Let's turn to one of the final topics, and that's choice and consult. I'm very passionate about choice and consult. You'll know that, Linda.
I do.
What will you do to build the capacity of participants to exercise choice and consult?
Yep. It's something that I've learnt a lot about in the last 12 months in this job, and it's something that, again, I've been thinking very deeply about. And choice and control has always been and will always remain a key pillar or principle on which the NDIS operates. It has to, because it is all about empowering people who are on the scheme to take, you know, more control of their own lives and, you know, how they live their lives and how they're supported to live your life. So I think it's an important issue, not just for me or for the minister of the day or the ministers across all states and territories, but I think it's a really important discussion for us all to have. You know, what does choice and control actually mean? And choice and control might mean something a bit different for you as it does for other participants. But one of the things I think that it's been very interesting for me to explore choice and control with people, for example, with a cognitive or an intellectual disability. And are we doing enough to ensure that they truly can exercise their own choice and control? Or do people have, you know, other people who are acting on their behalf, who are making decisions for them, that perhaps don't really reflect, you know, their own choice and control? So I think in a practical sense, it's still a discussion we have to have as a nation. But I think it's also important in terms of co-design. Now, it's something that I know the first conversation, you know, you and I had about co-design. And I'm still a bit nervous to actually try and define, because every time I do, I seem to get into trouble because different people have different perceptions of co-design. But for me, I really got that people who are impacted by the scheme or people who have a stake in the scheme must be consulted on the future directions of the scheme.
It's more than consulted, right? Like, this is what we're on about, where we're saying that we make decisions together. And we do that because if we involve people from the outset, they're going to make the decision a lot more informed and a lot higher quality.
I think you've just made my point for me, George. in the amendments to the NDIS Act that have just gone through, we've enshrined in the legislation now that co-design has to be considered when making changes to the scheme and, you know, how it's governed. So it also puts in legislation the need to have people with lived experience of disability on the board. And as you know, I appointed two amazing women with disability onto the board. So it's a change in direction. But again, I think coming back to your first question about if I was the minister after the election, what I would like to do, I would like to keep working on how do we live and breathe the principles of co-design. We're doing that now with the IAC, I think, more effectively. And with the consultations the NDIA is now doing about SIL, about early childhood interventions, about SDA, that is all actually doing things in consultation and collaboration with the right stakeholders.
Linda, this is my last question.
Should I be scared, George?
No. It's your chance to tell people why they need to look to you as our NDIS leader post the election. Why should they vote for you?
Well, George, that is a very, very good question. And I think that what I have brought to the portfolio and what I've tried to bring to the portfolio is a genuine spirit of collaboration and consultation, but also action. Because there have been, you know, as a minister, you were only a custodian of your portfolio for a particular, you know, for a slice of time. And I think over the last 12 months, you know, I listened, I heard, I acted on independent assessments. I've put in place a collaborative approach on new participant-centred assessment processes, again, to be co-designed with the IAC and the sector. I've, you know, had many meetings with the states and territories, I said six, and, you know, we are collaborating. I've heard about SIL and, you know, we've acted. I heard about Anne-Marie Smith and the circumstances, and I not only introduced legislation, I got that passed. I got the participant service guarantee and other important reforms for participants through the parliament. But that only happens is when you work together. I respect the sector. You know, people like yourselves who are very strong and passionate advocates, but we can only do things together. And I learnt that through the COVID vaccination process, is that the reason we now have the highest vaccination rates in the world for people with disability, and particularly those on the NDIS, is because I work together with the states and territories. I work together with Greg Hunt. I work together with the sector and took their advice on, you know, what were some of the barriers were and how we could collectively work to deal with that. So, you know, funding is not an issue. Both sides have committed to fully funding the NDIS. We've put $157 billion into doing that. But the real issue now is how do we make the scheme better and better? You know, we've had so many reviews. We know what we need to do. And I believe that over the last 12 months, I have demonstrated to the sector that I can work with the sector, I can work with states and territories. I worked with the opposition to get the legislation through. And, you know, none of us can do this together. But I fervently and passionately believe in this scheme. I think that it says so much about Australians that, you know, no other country has a scheme like it, and that we are willing to provide that support to 500,000 Australians so that they can live, you know, a wonderfully ordinary life and a life of their choice. So it is not perfect, but it's on its way to improving. And again, you know, just seeing and hearing the stories of so many peoples whose lives have been transformed. You know, I know it is a great scheme. This government knows that it's a great scheme. And, you know, if I am still the minister after the election, I will certainly be continuing to work with everybody who has a stake in the scheme to improve it. And, you know, that's what I offer, George.
Linda, I can vouch for that. You are a collaborator and that you've always made yourself available to talk to me. And I thank you for that. And I wish you the best of luck on the 21st of May.
Thank you very much, George. And can I just say I've so valued your frank and fearless advice, but also your very constructive approach, because ultimately identifying problems is really easy. Actually finding the solutions and then being able to implement them together, you know, that is the real knack of government, but also of, you know, people like yourselves, like yourself, in how we work together to keep making it better.
Thanks, Linda. Good night.
Thanks, George.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Reasonable and Necessary. Remember that this is just one of a series of episodes for the federal election. So make sure you check them all out, including our final analysis episode, which is a ripper. To be notified of future episodes, don't forget to hit the subscribe button and the notification bell. You can also follow me on Twitter at Dr. George the Crip. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.